You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The word cannibal derives from Cannibalis, a Spanish name for the Caribs, a West Indies tribe that were reported by Christopher Columbus to be eaters of human flesh. Although it's thought to be rare among humans these days, it is more common than you might think. In his new book, Cannibalism, A Perfectly Natural History, Bill Shutt, who is a professor of biology at LIU Post and a research associate at the American Museum of Natural History, separates fact from fiction and attempts to discover some larger truths about when, where, and why cannibalism occurs. It's published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill, and I'm very pleased it has brought Bill Shutt to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Hasn't the word cannibal usually been used to describe human activity, and yet cannibalism is rarer in mammals than it is in invertebrates?
Yeah, I think there's a misconception. When you hear the word cannibalism, you think about Jeffrey Dahmer or you think about the Donner Party. You don't necessarily think about parental care and hundreds of different species of animals.
It's in humans, it's usually associated with food scarcity, or it has been. Do different species have different reasons for engaging in cannibalism?
Absolutely. One of the things that really surprised me when I got into writing this book was how common it was across the entire animal kingdom for reasons like parental care. You lay eggs that are never going to be that are never going to hatch, and they are, in a sense, kids' meals, and they're called trophic eggs. And these would be laid by many species of insects, spiders, snails. And it just goes on and on. There are great examples of parental care, like these legless amphibians, Sicilians, which there are some that lay eggs. When those hatchlings first appear, they start to swarm around their mom. And people for the longest time didn't really take a closer look at that behavior. And when they did, they realized that the babies were peeling their mother's skin, kind of like you'd peel a grape, and eating it. And so they looked at the skin and they went, well, you know, this doesn't look like regular epidermis. It's not dead, flaky skin. It's fat-laden, nutritious. And that's
so it's there for the babies to eat.
Absolutely. And then you look at the species that have live births, and scientists looked at the babies and they said, well, what are these little weird teeth that they're born with? And they just fell off as soon as they're born. And they went, why do they have a tooth that falls off at birth? So they did some dissections on preserved specimens, and they found out that the places in the oviducts where the babies were developing had been peeled away.
Now, when modern mothers eat the placenta after the birth of their children, would you call that cannibalism?
I do. And I think that's probably one of the only examples now of medicinal cannibalism that we have left.
We'll talk about other kinds of medicinal cannibalism later, but I want to get historic here. Obviously, cannibalism existed for a long time, but it really begins in human consciousness after Christopher Columbus labels the Caribs, this group of locals he heard of during his 1492 voyage, as cannibals. What was his evidence?
Well, I don't know if he had evidence, and if there was evidence, it might have been evidence that of funerary practices where the indigenous people were actually doing this to their dead. Instead of burying them, they would preserve their bones in their homes, and he went in and interpreted that as cannibalism was taking place.
He described them as savage, with dog-like noses, and they drink the blood of their victims. He also said that the people had one eye in their foreheads, and yet people believed what he was saying?
Yeah, I think this is after they figured out that there wasn't a whole lot of gold in the Caribbean, and they were looking for something else to exploit, and they did.
It's been suggested that it became an excuse for treating these people as less than human.
Absolutely. You know, when word came down from Queen Isabella that you needed to treat these people with respect, but if they were found to be cannibals, then all bets were off. Then the next two or three voyages were like invasions.
But they never found these one-eyed, dog-nosed
Not
people.
That I know of.
One of the best-known stories involving human cannibalism is the Donner Party expedition of 1846-1847. What happened there? Is this also a suspect story?
Absolutely not. And the reason that's, to me, it's the most famous of the cannibalism stories in the United States. And when I first started to write this book, I thought, well, how much is not known about this? So I started off thinking, I might avoid this. But at that point, there was this flap developed where I read a bunch of headlines saying the Donner Party might not have been cannibalism, partaken of cannibalism. So I said, what is this about? And it appears that what happened was a PR department in a college jumped the gun on some research that was being done by one of their professors, and misinterpreted it to being that no human cannibalism had taken place. In reality, that just was not the case. When the study came out, there was no argument about that.
Because that's how they survived.
Yeah, and cannibalism was probably undertaken at four different sites during that horrible winter, and no one really that does any work with it had any doubt that it occurred.
Was the professor Dr. William Ahrens?
No, it wasn't. No.
He's another one who questions the talk of cannibalism.
Yeah, I met with Bill Ahrens and at Stony Brook, and in 1979 when he wrote this book, the Man-Eating Myth, everybody was completely freaked out because they thought, how can this guy say that cannibalism never occurred in any organized form throughout history? And when I spoke to him, if you read between the lines now, I think what he was doing was he got people talking about the fact that the term cannibalism was used as a club to go in by all sorts of flag-planting Western countries to exploit the people that they met. And also served as sort of an alarm to anthropologists to be a little bit more careful with what they were describing as this group cannibalized because there were other explanations for some of the things that they found.
Well, it is part of the problem is that it has become cannibalism has entered the popular culture, so we find a lot of it in horror movies, a lot more than in real life.
Sure.
But it's like vampires and werewolves. There are probably people who really believe they exist.
Right.
The living dead.
Yeah. I mean, this cannibalism taboo has been ingrained in us since the time of the Greeks and Homer with Polyphemus and from there the Romans and from there Shakespeare. And it just has steamrolled into Sigmund Freud and Daniel Defoe, and it's just really taken a life of its own, so that whenever you hear that term now, you have this knee-jerk reaction to what cannibalism is.
My guest is Bill Schutt, Schutt. His book, Cannibalism, a perfectly natural history. So let's talk about real examples of cannibalism. First, in Europe, there was something called medicinal cannibalism, and it was practiced in Europe from the Middle Ages all the way into the early 20th century?
A huge surprise to me, especially given the cannibalism taboo, that every part of the human body was used in just about every country that you can mention in Europe for all sorts of purposes, whether it was grinding up the skull into a powder or applying fat to your skin and to your skin if you had a skin problem, and then consuming it for rheumatism, and drinking blood for epilepsy.
Now, why did they think that blood would cure epilepsy? You report that people would wait at executions to get the blood. Epileptics would wait at executions to get some of the blood.
Yeah, I think this went back to Galen, the Roman physician, and his whole idea of the fact that there are these four humors, one of them being blood, that are incredibly important in any disease that you might get, and you needed to balance these. So with blood being so important, consuming it was thought to have curative powers.
And there was also cannibalism was used for medical treatments in China.
Mm-hmm.
But they have a very different historical relationship to the practice than the West?
I believe so. And I think, once again, this is because they didn't have those Western taboos to tell them that cannibalism was wrong. So throughout China, for probably thousands of years, cannibalism was employed for medicinal purposes, for terrorism. There was culinary cannibalism. There was this aspect of filial piety where a Confucian mindset where you take care of your elders, and in an extreme form, you would cut off parts of your body, biceps or muscle or some flesh from your leg, and you'd feed it to your elders as sort of a last-ditch effort to save them.
What about all of the stories of headhunters and the like? The people of Papua New Guinea, were they real cannibals?
Yeah. I'm sure cannibalism took place in a number of cultures. There's an argument about how many. Certainly,
the Amazon was another.
Yeah. And certainly the Foray in New Guinea were cannibals, and they were doing it as a way to deal with their dead. And these were people that they loved. They were relatives. And instead of burying them, they would parcel out their body parts, especially for the women and the children, which became a big piece of evidence when Kuru was discovered, this disease that is associated with cannibalism.
Because mad cow disease.
Yeah, mad cow disease. There's a form that you find in mink, and Kuru are all spongiform encephalopathies. They're degenerative nerve disorders. They're untreatable and 100% fatal.
So this really occurs, but you also have to question whether cannibalism isn't cited as a way of saying these people are savages and we have to treat them differently. I heard a lot of that in the Amazon, but I don't know if I've ever heard of real instances of cannibalism in the Amazon.
Sure. I think that, you know, once again, it's probably much more common that you would use that, you would find that term used as a way to dehumanize these people that you are that you're meeting.
On the other hand, you tell of a number of stories of cannibalism across the animal kingdom. One of the most common is that a female praying mantis will eat the male during the mating process. Does that actually occur?
Yeah, it probably occurs less than is popularly thought, because most of the initial work that was done on that was done in captive conditions where the females were reportedly starved. But there are instances where male mantises are killed during the mating process, and in some sense that is that's reproductive behavior, because the male is ensuring not only that his genes are being passed on, because the female is less likely to mate again if she gets a meal out of, you know, eats her husband. So I think that's a natural occurrence. She gets a good meal and is carrying his genes, and you know, he sort of checks out at that point.
It's the supreme sacrifice. There's also the Australian redback spider.
Yeah,
these are fascinating stories.
Yeah, relative of the black widow, and the black widow being another species that most of the work had been done on starved females. And so, but the Australian redback is fascinating, because the male sort of presents his body to the female right after they mate, and she responds by eating him.
And then there's the sand tiger shark.
Yeah, local species. Probably my second favorite parental care example. And you find that in these sharks, which don't lay eggs, you can think of it this way, the eggs hatch internally. And there are eggs of different ages. And so the oldest eggs hatch, and these fetuses move around in the oviducts and consume all of the rest of the eggs. And when the eggs are gone, they'll consume their younger brethren, so that when the birth occurs, there are only two sharks, one from each oviduct, and they're, in a sense, they've been trained to be predators.
Talking about eggs, do we ever see this among birds?
Yeah. The lifeboat strategy that had became sort of a catchphrase for what happens when you're stranded and you've got to draw straws and eat the guy who loses. That was derived from birds, because birds lay asynchronous. They lay their eggs asynchronously, one today, one tomorrow, one the next day. So you've got hatchlings that are older than others, and if the mother can feed them, then okay, well maybe the smallest guy gets to survive. But if there's not a lot of food there, then the larger nestlings will kill and eat the smallest one.
Should I assume, since birds do it, that their ancestors, the dinosaurs, also engaged in this kind of activity?
Yeah,
do we have evidence?
Yeah, controversial. There's one. It used to be that we thought that all dinosaurs were cannibals, and that was because of this dinosaur Coelophysis, and they found, you know, back in the day, they found all of these bones in the abdominal region, and they thought, oh, they've eaten their young. And then pretty recently, Mark Norell at the AMNH did work to show that these were not the bones of a Coelophysis. They were crocodilomorphs. But then again, there have been some instances where dinosaur bones have been found where there are no other large predators around, with tooth marks that fit the skulls and the teeth of the same species. So we do think it did occur.
And recently we have heard that people who used to be called the Anasazi, now there are other names, the Pueblo people of the Four Corners area, may have also engaged in cannibalism. These are people who we generally thought had developed a relatively high culture before they disappeared.
Probably from what I learned, it might have been employed as a method to terrorize. If it did occur, it seems to have been something.
Well, what kind of evidence? Is it the markings on the bones that might suggest that humans had engaged in this kind of activity?
Yeah, and I'm not talking specifically about the Anasazi, but if you find bones that have been cut, and this is one of the things that I think that Bill Ahrens was trying to get people not to sort of fall into this trap that if you find bones with cut marks, it must mean cannibalism. You've got to find these bones treated the same way as game. So you got to find them in a pile of deer bones. And at that point, then you can probably assume that cannibalism took place. But if you're just finding bones if you found a skeleton of somebody that had been killed by a bayonet, let's say, 100 years later, you don't want to misinterpret that he was cannibalized.
Now, this kind of investigation goes along with your job, but when you told people you were writing about cannibalism, did they say, ugh?
It's funny. No one did. My first book was on blood and blood-feeding creatures. And when I talk to people that I haven't spoken to in 20 years and they catch me on Facebook or something, and they go, what do you do for a living? And I'm like, well, I write a book about vampires, and now I'm writing one about cannibals. No one is surprised.
Bill Schutt. Schutt is a professor of biology at LIU Post, a research associate in residence at the American Museum of Natural History. His latest book, Cannibalism, A Perfectly Natural History, published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Thank you so much for being on our show.
What a pleasure it was to talk to you. Thank you.